Some say essential nutrients went missing when we civilized our food. And as civilized people, we pay for that loss with sickness and disease. This thought leads us to ask, can farming return the nutrients that have gone missing in our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 961st edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Pucallpa who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Now, Aaron.
Yes.
Do you think farming can put the nutrients back into food?
If they took it out, they could put it back in.
Okay, there you go. Also with us today, we have a whole studio full of intern Food Chain producers. We're really happy to have them aboard. Patricia Souza, you have to say hello there.
Hi.
Okay, Kristen Carlson.
Good morning.
And Anna Ringelman.
Hello.
Okay, folks, here we go. Following in the footsteps of dentist Weston A. Price, family physician Daphne Miller went looking for healthy people. And like Price, she found them in primitive cultures. Among the elements that gave those primitive people healthy bodies and long lives was the primitive foods they ate. Now, what made the difference was that what was in primitive foods but not in civilized foods, and what was not in primitive foods but what was in civilized foods. Let me explain. What Price and Miller discovered was that primitive foods are not as big or pretty as civilized foods, often contained a higher concentration of essential nutrients. Thus, primitive people could eat less food and yet get more essential nutrition. What primitive foods did not contain were the synthetic additives that give civilized foods their taste and shelf life, including synthetic sugars, partially hydrogenated oils, chemical preservatives, and so on and on and on. You read the labels, you know. Considering the consequence of eating foods in which essential nutrients have gone missing and which have been replaced by synthetic elements, both Price and Miller seem to conclude that eating civilized foods can be hazardous to our health. This thought leads us to ask, can farming return the nutrients that have gone missing in our food? Well, here to help us examine the question, we have Dr. Daphne Miller, who is the author of The Jungle Effect and Pharmacopoeia. Dr. Miller, welcome to the Food Chain. Well, let's see. Go ahead one more time.
Thank you so much.
Okay, got you now. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Miller. So pleased to have you. Enjoyed reading your works. But I have a question. What happened to the doctor that became an author that is now running around in the jungle looking for healthy people? How did that happen?
Oh, well, I wasn't running around in the jungle. I was actually walking very slowly because it's quite hot there. But I think that there's a number of things that really have pointed me in this direction of trying to learn both from traditional cooks and traditional farmers. And it is realizing that we have a lot to learn that's not necessarily been handed down to us by the inventions of technology. Not to say that I'm anti-technology in any way, and in fact, I use a lot of it in my practice. But I really feel that as physicians, we need to open up our toolboxes and not only learn from, you know, what we are inventing in our labs and within our computers, but also a lot of the wisdom that's been there for thousands of years, and which is in and of itself very, very useful. So that really is, you know, part of the work that I do is sort of blending the old with the new.
Mm-hmm. So most of the time when we go see the doctor, we say, this hurts here, they say, here, take this and come call me in 2 weeks and you'll be much better. But you seem to have listened to the patron saint of physicians, that being Hippocrates, who said, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. What led you off in that direction?
It's actually really interesting, Michael, because Hippocrates actually never said that. I think that's probably one of the biggest misquotations ever. In fact, if you read the original that he wrote, he's very explicit that food shouldn't be medicine.
So that was a total misappropriation of Hippocrates.
It was a misappropriation of Hippocrates, and I think that's a really important distinction to make, because food, if you think about it, it isn't medicine. It's healing, and it has the potential to keep us incredibly healthy throughout our lives, or actually make us incredibly sick. But medicine, and even in the time of Hippocrates, was something that didn't get taken into your cells, into your body. It was something that worked very much as a foreigner within you. I mean, this is the same way as we think of, you know, an antidepressant now, or diabetes medicine or something like that. Medicines tend to work quickly, immediately, and have very kind of a reductionist effect. Food is so complicated, and it has its impact on your health over dozens and dozens of years. And so what's part of our problem as a culture is we tend to think of food as medicine and try and reduce it down to its constituent parts, when it really is something that we have to think of much more holistically in terms of how it keeps us healthy.
Who do you think misappropriated Hippocrates?
That's actually a really interesting thing. There's a lot of discussion about that in the historical medical literature, and it's something that slowly happened, over decades. But I think where we've really seized on it, the whole idea, has been in the past 10 or 15 years with the whole nutraceutical movement, where we really have been trying to find that magic ingredient. You know, let me tell you this superfood or this ingredient, or this oil is better for you than this oil because it lowers cholesterol. So, you know, or this, this specific fruit is going to, be an anti-aging fruit because it has resveratrol or this other ingredient in it. And basically what we've tried to do is pharmaceuticalize our food. And anybody, who is really involved in cooking or farming can tell you that food is this very complex ingredient that takes on the characteristics of all of its companions within the dish. It's not a medicine.
It's food.
It's food. And it can be incredibly healing and important. It can make the difference between well or not well. But I think it's important to make that distinction.
Weston A. Price, it seems like you're following in his footsteps. Are you?
Well, Weston Price was a dentist who was very forward-thinking and was really great at observing things. And he also, like me, had the travel bug. And he traveled around the globe looking at people's teeth. And he went to a lot of places where I actually ended up visiting about 40, 50 years later, but went to a lot of places where people were still very much eating a traditional diet. And what he recognized there was that he wasn't seeing cavities the same way he was seeing them in his practice, where he was working. Forgive me, but I can't remember where his practice was in the Western world. But, making the comparison between the two places, he realized that food was probably a huge component of what was allowing these traditional communities to not have modern-day cavities. And it turns out that our teeth are just one manifestation of, our physical health. And when I was working in Peru in the rainforest, I was seeing exactly the same thing with other health issues. Like I was virtually seeing no diabetes, no heart disease, no depression, very little cancer. I was seeing a lot of illnesses that I never see in my practice in San Francisco, like snake bites and machete wounds and tetanus and malaria. But I was not seeing what we would call our modern chronic diseases, and certainly nowhere near the rate that I see them in San Francisco.
Well, so we're going to, Doctor, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I do want you to take us to the Peruvian jungles. I have been there myself, so I like to compare notes and talk about the food of the jungle and the jungle effect, which, of course, just happens to be the title of one of your books. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, today we're talking about primitive foods and civilized foods, and did we lose something in the translation from primitive to civilized? It would seem so, as Dr. Miller says. She didn't see any of the modern times diseases in the primitive cultures of the Amazon. Well, that's where we're going when we come back. So do stay tuned. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, folks, let's head south to the Amazon, the Peruvian Amazon. I had the opportunity to visit the area once. We flew into the little village, little town of Pacalpa, and then jumped on a bus and went down to the Rio Ucayali, and then got on boats and motored up the Rio Ucayali for a number of hours to the little village of Porvenir. And it was probably one of those experiences that you always remember because it was like a jungle paradise. We pulled into this long lagoon that led up to the village, and it was kind of a wonderful vision, almost like Maxfield Parrish painting, as we went through the silky smooth water. Pink dolphins jumped out of the water and followed our boats, and the magnificent jungle rain clouds and sunshine, and it was just spectacular. But what struck me were the people. They were truly beautiful people, and their village was really clean. And having been in a lot of developing nation villages, and what struck me most was that there was no garbage. And I wondered at the fact that there was no garbage strewn about, and then I realized that there was no place for them to buy garbage. It was that far away. There was just no place for them to buy things that come in wrappers. Everything was organic. And the people were healthy. The only sick person in the village was the village chief, who happened to step on a stingray in the river when he was harpooning our dinner. And that was it. Even the old people looked old, but they didn't look old. They looked young old. Dr. Daphne Miller, you also went down into the Peruvian Amazon. Did you find the same kind of thing?
Well, your observation about there being no trash is really a very spot on, in that, you know, it's really rare in this world to get to a place where that is so remote that you really can't buy convenience foods that come wrapped in wrappers. And that was very much my experience when I was in the little village where I was. I was there actually because I was filling in for the doctor who normally worked in that village. And the clinic that we worked in, by the way, was really nothing more than a lean-to. It was a pretty basic clinic, and it was the only clinic for at least 50 miles, a 50-mile radius, and it was accessed by the local community. They would come in their dugout canoes to be seen. And the kinds of illnesses that I did see, some of which were quite heartbreaking and very preventable, like infant diarrheal diseases or, as I've mentioned before, things like malaria and tetanus, and certainly lots of wounds just from, you know, walking around barefoot or being exposed to machetes and so on. But it was just striking to me how little I saw the modern chronic diseases that I take care of in San Francisco. But one of the other things that also was striking to me was that it was starting to be a community in transition, meaning that those packaged foods were starting to find their way in because there were more motorboats that were coming up the tributary to that village, and there were more people from the village that were going up to Iquitos, which is the nearest big city, for work and so on. So you were starting to see people who were, for the first time, overweight and whose blood sugars were starting to spike. And the dentist who worked occasionally in the village was for the first time starting to see cavities and things like that. So even these incredibly remote places are starting to experience what we call the nutrition transition, mm-hmm. where they're moving from the traditional local foods to the more modern ones. And within one generation, we see that those communities start to develop diabetes, heart disease, and so on at literally the same rate as we see them in the United States, if not more.
Mm-hmm. And which very much parallels Dr. Price's findings with respect to the dental work. When people go from that primitive diet to the civilized foods, you know, probably the first thing that starts to go is their teeth and then their jaws and so on. I'd like to talk a little bit about the foods that those people ate, because the foods that I had at the villages that we did visit was absolutely stunning. I mean, it was just delicious. And we went for a walk in the rainforest with the shaman, which they call the curandero, which other people might call a witch doctor. And we walked out into the woods and he was giving a lecture on, you know, some of the medicinal properties of some of the plants. But his remark was that the rainforest is the most competitive environment in the world. And he said, you know, if you just watch a leaf fall to the ground, you'll see that that leaf will be attacked immediately by all kinds of organisms that take it apart. And all of that nutrition in that leaf immediately goes right back into the canopy. And he said that, you know, to survive in this environment, an organism has to be the strongest of the strong. And that's what we eat. Is that what you said?
Oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. I do think that, you know, even within that environment, there's actually a lot of farming that took place. It was just not farming in the way that we would recognize it. So it wasn't just, you know, going out and foraging things that were growing naturally. And in fact, I'm interested in your distinction that you're using between sort of primitive and civilized foods, because I wouldn't necessarily think about it that way, because I actually think of most of what we eat as fairly primitive now here in the U.S. And it's civilized, meaning if you mean food that's been touched or manipulated by man, in fact, there's a lot of that that goes on in these traditional cultures. I mean,
absolutely.
We've been doing hybridization and you know, ways of manipulating seeds for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And even when you look at in a place like the Amazon, a lot of the things that they are growing, from the manioc roots to the different kinds of hearts of palm, to the chickens that they raise there, they're all a product of you know, our tinkering with what was there. And
absolutely.
So in a way they're highly civilized food. But they're not, you know, synthetic foods. They're not foods that have where we're, you know, bringing in a lot of sort of machine-made stuff. But we've been tinkering with our food and civilizing our food all over the globe for thousands of years. I mean, 10,000 years to be exact. not that that's an exact number, but, you know, just ever since we began practicing modern agriculture. But what I found in the jungle was that as you're walking along, you, or I, as the untrained eye, might think that I'm looking at just a patch of crazy overgrown jungle vines. But then someone would show me, no, look, this is my garden. And really what they practice is an incredible kind of permaculture where what they're growing is very much a part of the local ecosystem. And so it does very well in that competitive cycle that you just described. And, you know, it's able to live along with the more native plants that are just, you know, springing out of the ground there. In that way, their gardens are very productive and they're not fighting back the weeds, so to speak, in order to grow their food, because their food, you know, works just as well within that ecosystem. And when I came back from Peru, I looked at my garden. I said, this is so silly. The garden that I'm making is trying to fight, you know, the weeds that are growing up around it. And I really changed my whole way of gardening here in Berkeley, you know, to be more of a permaculture, you know, jungle-based system.
And there you are. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking with Dr. Daphne Miller, and we're talking about the nature of food, and we go from the foods from the what I call the more primitive cultures, which is to say the cultures that haven't been synthesized with genetically modified organisms, synthetic fertilizers, and those kinds of things. And what happened to when we went to those new kinds of food that have been grown with synthetic materials? That's where we want to pick up when we get back. What happened to our food and what is happening to us? Do stay tuned right back. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Dr. Daphne Miller, author of The Jungle Effect and Pharmacopoeia. Doctor, your work seems to be headed in a really interesting direction, but I'd like to take you back a little bit and ask you, what exactly is the jungle effect?
Yeah, let me just add also that my most latest book is called Pharmacology with an F. It's not Pharmacopoeia.
Pharmacology.
Just in case your listeners are trying to find it, I don't want them lost in the mist there. It's Pharmacology, pharmacology.
Well captured.
But thank you. So I am originally what started me on the jungle effect was actually seeing a patient in my office in San Francisco who was originally from the rainforest in Brazil. She'd grown up there. And she had gone home on vacation, actually to an uncle of hers had died, and she went home for the funeral and then stayed there for a while. And she was someone who was in her late 30s and had already started to develop some problems with her blood sugar and with her blood pressure, and she had gained about 15 or 20 pounds recently, and she was feeling very unwell. And when she went back to Brazil, to her village there, all of a sudden her health problems started to get better. Her blood pressure went down, her blood sugars stabilized, and she dropped back to her previous weight. And then she came back to San Francisco, and all her problems came back again. And so she had come into my medical office in San Francisco to tell me the story and to ask me what had caused what she called this jungle effect. She said, you know, in fact, when I was home in Brazil, I feel like I was eating more and exercising less in my village there than I do here in San Francisco, and yet I was healthier there. And I remember at the time listening to her story and sort of giving her not very useful advice, you know, like, you know, eat less, exercise more, something like that, you know, something that your doctor traditionally tells you to do, you know, take in fewer calories and, you know, try and go to the gym a couple days a week. But then it was about 6 months later that I ended up taking this job in the rainforest in Peru, right basically across the border from my patient, who we'll call Angela. That's how I refer to her in the book. And it was when I was in the village there that all of a sudden I had this epiphany and realized really what that jungle effect was, that it was being in a place where you were eating all these traditional foods and actually moving your body in a way that wasn't necessarily getting up and going to the gym for a half hour in the morning and then sitting at a desk all day, but was moving your body throughout the day in a maybe a less vigorous way than going to the gym, but being active. And also surrounded by a community that was supportive and loving, and you know, there were many other aspects as well that seemed to be more health-giving of being in that traditional culture. But then, you know, I came back to San Francisco, and I not only did I get back to Angela and give her recipes that I thought would be useful and other ideas that I thought would be useful, but this epiphany really sent me around the globe to places where they still have very low rates of modern chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, to figure out what was the traditional diet there and how what I could learn about it and bring back to my practice in San Francisco. So I ended up going to Crete in Greece because they have very low rates of heart disease, and I went to Okinawa in Japan where they have very low rates of breast and prostate cancer. And I went to Iceland because they, ironically, they have lower rates of depression than other Northern European countries, and I wanted to see what that was linked to. I went to Cameroon in West Africa because they have very low rates of colon cancer and other kinds of problems related to colon health, like hemorrhoids and diverticulitis and so on. So, you know, each place was a different adventure. And I spent time in Copper Canyon in Mexico trying to understand why the Tarahumara Indians have such low rates of diabetes when their blood relatives, the Pima Indians of Arizona, have such high rates of diabetes. You know, what made the difference there?
So, what is the difference, Doctor? What is the difference between those foods and our foods?
Right. Well, it's fascinating. Taking the example of the Tarahumara, one of the things that I realized when I was down in Copper Canyon was not only do they not have access to the foods that we know are the big killers here in the U.S., things like deep-fried foods and you know, Coca-Cola and lots of red meat, and especially lots of unhealthy red meat that's been grown in a factory setting. But the thing for me that was the most striking in Copper Canyon was all the foods that they do have access to that we don't have access to here. And those are specifically healing foods. For example, the Tarahumara, if you go and look at a traditional Tarahumaran household, they are surrounded by a gateway of nopales, which are, you know, cacti. And these nopali are actually part of their diet. They're very much a staple in the diet. They're used all the time, you know, in cooked into stews and grilled and so on. And if you start to look at the ingredients within the nopalis, and ethnobotanists have gone down there and studied these, what they find is that these plants are very effective when you eat them over the long term of helping you lower your blood sugar levels.
Kind of, and like the opposite of our potato, then.
Well, yeah, of our big starchy potato.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, and so, and they found the same thing in many other herbs that grow around there, that they all are, you know, good at helping us manage blood sugar. Now, they don't do it in the same way as a blood sugar medication, which is why I'm very clear to say they're not medicine. And that, you know, we take a blood sugar medicine that helps us lower our blood sugar, like glucotrol or metformin, and our blood sugar shoots down within a couple hours, you know. That's the way the medication works. These don't do that. These are foods that you have to incorporate into your diet and really eat throughout your, you know, your days and your lifetime, and have it be a part of your culture in order for them to keep you healthy. But when ethnobotanists went down there, they found over 300 foods that help control blood sugars. So when the Tarahumara leave that culture and move to, let's say, the Mission in San Francisco, they're losing all that important lifelong medicine.
Mm-hmm. And then they get into Doritos and Hostess Ding Dongs and away things go. Well, when we get back from this break, I'd like to ask Dr. Daphne Miller, the author of The Jungle Effect and Pharmacology, what happened to our industrialized food system to cause us so much seemingly diseases and whatnot? What on earth went wrong? Also, it seems like there was a key that you brought up, Dr. Miller, in location. It seems like the Indians of Copper Canyon had all of these wonderful things right about them. Might we as well? This is The Food Chain. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these messages with Dr. Daphne Miller and you. Dr. Miller, you have us all talking here about local, and we were listening to you talking about the people who live in the Copper Canyon, and then we got to thinking, gee whiz, it's almost like all of the cultures that you identified had somehow keyed in on local foods. Is that an element here?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the two, you know, there's two ideas to hold on to in terms of food and health. One is local, and the other is diverse. And I think, you know, in terms of the question that you raised before we went to break, in terms of what is making us sick and with our modern food, and it really is, you know, a lack of those two things. It's that, you know, we've sort of subscribed to a food system where we really are producing about three foods made of three types of things.
Yeah, let me guess. Corn, soy, and...
Yeah, corn, soy, and wheat, basically. Yeah. You know, with a little bit of, dairy thrown in for good measure. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of vegetable oil made from corn, soy, and wheat. But, you know, all of which is A, generally not local, and B, not diverse. And when you start to think of a diet where you really are eating a rainbow of foods, both in terms of their color, in terms of, you know, their shape and so on, and also foods that really are, you know, working with your seasons and that are produced in at least in some kind of relative radius to where you live. And I'm not against food moving, across the continent or even across the globe in certain cases. But I think that, you know, trying to get most of your diet, within some kind of reasonable distance from your home, then it's just by definition going to be a lot healthier. But this idea generally I don't, when I'm doing interviews, I don't sit and listen to the ads that are playing in between the segments. but your advertisers, I mean, they're a wonderful testament to really what we should be doing to be healthy. I mean, it's really it's a testament to what a great show you have too. But, you know, you have OFRF, which is this, you know, organic research fund, and then you have this Knox Garden Boxes where, you know, my cure-all for that what ails us as a country would be for everybody to have a garden box, you know, to put a Knox Garden Box in every home, you know, and have us start to grow getting some local seeds and really starting to grow things that are meaningful to us in terms of what we like to eat and also that work within that place, within that region. And
Kristen has a very interesting question about local bacteria. Kristen?
Oh, I just wanted to ask, what are the potential effects of the fact that we are taking in food from all over the planet, and how might the fact that those are all different bacterias be interacting with our body versus eating from a local area where you're getting the local bacteria?
That's a really interesting question, and I wish we were even beginning to be at a place where we could, from a scientific standpoint, be able to answer something, a question that is that interesting and that smart. But what we are starting to be able to understand. You know, this whole idea of the bacterial world and how it influences our health is we're just at the very beginning. You know, we're just sort of tinkering with the idea at this point, you know, in terms of the where the science is going to end up going. But what we do understand is that all those billions of bacteria that are in our intestine are not just in an isolated bubble, and that they are constantly interacting with bacteria from the outside world, and that the bacteria that comes to us from the soil via the food that we eat is actually probably an important lever on the health of our internal biome. And that if you treat that soil well, then the food that grows in that soil is going to be transmitting healthy messages to the bacteria in our intestine. And if you treat that soil poorly, then the opposite is going to take place. And there's a couple researchers that are doing some very interesting work. One guy named Gautam Dantas, who's looking at the bacteria that comes from soil that's been treated with a lot of pesticides and herbicides tends to transmit DNA to the bacteria in our gut, which gives it the ability to transform into kind of a superbug or an antibiotic-resistant bug. So we can get very negative or dangerous messages from the bacteria in the soil if that soil has been poorly treated, which really gets me to the point that, we were talking about food as medicine earlier, and I was saying how maybe that's not the best way for us to think of food, but maybe we should start thinking of farm as medicine, you know, and that truly what is influencing our health is the way that our food is grown and the farms on which our food is grown. And most of us just don't pay enough attention to that. We really don't care about the details of how our food is grown.
Well, and that's what we're going to pick up when we come back, because that is the question of the day. Can farming put those nutrients back into the food that have somehow gone missing in the translation from being foods from nature to foods from civilization, including all those bugs, those little tiny bugs? Yes. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Dr. Daphne Miller. She's a family physician who went in pursuit of healthy people all over the world. And then in her next book, Pharmacology, she asks the question, you know, what can we do to put the food back in the food? We will be right back. Do stay tuned. Chain Radio Program. We're going to pick up a quick call. We have Marshall on the line. Marshall, fire away.
Okay, short and sweet. From what I've heard, I am not going to get tetanus shots, and there's a problem with tetanus in the jungle. So does she, as a doctor, recommend we get tetanus shots? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marshall. There you go. The technical question, Dr. Miller.
That's very funny. I wasn't expecting that from this discussion, but
me neither. But that's talk radio, you know.
I do, especially if you're a farmer. I don't know what you do for a living, but if you're a farmer, you work around soils. Tetanus actually exists naturally in our soils. It's part of our ecosystem, but it's one of those diseases that you kind of don't want to get immunity to the natural way. Getting tetanus is, as I have seen firsthand, quite deadly. So, yes,
no fun.
That's
a pretty good recommendation, then. Go ahead and get a tetanus shot and save yourself getting tetanus.
It's every 10 years, and you get it with acellular pertussis, which is another one of those diseases that we see a recurrence of in adults. And it really sucks to cough for months on end.
So, yeah, into that. Well, Dr. Miller, let me ask you this. You know, we talked a lot about making this transition from a very local food to an international food, and as a consequence, picking up all of these modern times diseases. Is there a way of going back? You, the author of Pharmacology, can we do it?
Well, I think I have, at this point, great hope for our farming system. I'm feeling optimistic for the first time. And that's because in the past 2 years, we've seen, for the first time in decades in this country, an uptick in the number of young people who are going into agriculture. And they're specifically going into sustainable agriculture, with the belief that they want to rejuvenate our local farm systems and bring back our local seeds and really steward the land in a way that will make it healthier. And what happens with that is that the communities around these young farmers are going to get healthier, because these farmers are really on the front line of medicine. They are the ones who are providing those foods throughout a lifetime that will keep their communities healthy. So as we get these sustainable farm systems up and running, yes, we're going to put the nutrients back into food, and we're going to put the nutrients back into us.
And so whoever stole from Hippocrates wasn't too far off the mark then, were they, when they said, let thy food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food?
Yes, and my point was just that I think that when we start to really medicalize food, then we lose what its traditional meaning is, which is really something that sustains us in many more ways than just in terms of, you know, specific nutrients. It sustains us in terms of gluing our communities together. It keeps us healthy throughout the lifespan. Yeah.
One can think of drugs as being an invader, and one can think of food as being like home. Dr. Daphne Miller, the author of The Jungle Effect and Pharmacology, thank you so much for joining us. Boy, next time you head off to the jungle, let us know, and we'll all tag along with you. Folks, this has been A Food Chain. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.